When I started this series, I'd initially planned it to be purely historical, to start at the beginning and continue until we reached some point in the 21st century. But, as with all plans, I revise it and revise it and revise it. Now, I'd intended for this podcast to be about the Chinese philosopher Shunzi, and we will get to him, I promise. But today I wanted to talk not about philosophers I've taught, but about my own work, mostly because I wondered when I'd get around to it. Now, my own work in political theory has been focused on the Caribbean. Not too surprising, given my particular history and interests. And I've been interested in a couple of different things in relation to the Caribbean. One of them has to do with the question of what exactly should the identity of former colonized people in the Caribbean be, and how should that identity be derived? Because there are a number of ways this could happen. And the way it did in the former British territories in the Caribbean is of particular interest to me, mostly because that's where I spent a good chunk of my young life. So, what's all this about? The important thing we have to understand here is that from the beginning of its history, 5 centuries ago, the Caribbean has been a site of slavery, the enslavement, to be precise, of people mostly of West African origin to people mostly of European origin. And this racial slavery has been part of the defining characteristic of the region. But of course, the Caribbean is not unique. It is part of a larger region stretching from Maryland all the way down to the south of Brazil, which Charles Wagley, the geographer, called Plantation America. And in Plantation America, the central economic engine from the 16th through the 20th centuries was the plantation. The plantation was a total economic institution dedicated to the production of a single crop through either forced or tied labour. And we see that, for example, in the role played by sharecroppers and cotton plantations after slavery in the US, where the workers were tied to the plantation and so unable to survive without working on it. Likewise, slavery required the workers to be bound to the plantation and not permitted to survive unless they were working for and on it. The problem, of course, with slavery is that there's always one side that doesn't like it, and that side is, of course, the slaves. Slaves will endure slavery, but they do not like it and they do not want it, and where possible, they will object to it, sometimes with armed force. Now, this was the history of slavery in what we call the British West Indies, the British colonies in the Caribbean and on its periphery in Belize and the Guyana. The way we look at this is governed, of course, by the fact that those of us who look at it today are, for the most part, descended from the slaves, rather than being representatives of the owners alone. So, again, let me ask the basic question. What is this about? Slavery was introduced into the Caribbean by Christopher Columbus back at the end of the 15th century. And it became the major source of labour for plantation agriculture, indeed for everything else, from the 16th through the 19th centuries. The slaves naturally did not like this, and whenever possible, they rose against it. And they were, most of the time, driven back into slavery by force of gun and whip. Emphasis on that most of the time, because some of the time they weren't. And as a result, you have phenomena such as marronage, living free outside of the reach of slave owners in free communities, such as happened in, say, Jamaica, where there are still to this day five villages founded by Maroons in the 17th and 18th centuries that still exist to this day. Now, marronage was one form of resistance to slavery. Other major forms included actual revolt. But slavery, as a result, is an expensive system to maintain. It requires constant maintenance of military forces and the constant need to keep slave owners and other white people as part of active trained bands of militia. Not that the militia necessarily did much good. In fact, the typical sequence of a slave revolt was 1, the slaves would revolt, 2, the militia would come in, 3, the militia would run away, 4, the regular troops would come in. And that was that for about 300 years. However, the objections of the slaves to their enslavement, as I said, made slavery an expensive proposition. And slavery is morally difficult, morally dubious. How exactly can I, as a person, own another human being? How can I compel that human being to serve me by force? Those are real questions. And they are questions that have vexed people for a small matter of a couple of thousand years. And they haven't also always been well answered. Aristotle, and this is absolutely serious, suggested that some people were made for slavery and some people were not. The people who were not made for slavery were easy to identify. They spoke Greek. Now, as a standard, this isn't a particularly useful one for us because we mostly think it's wrong. And historically, it wasn't a very useful one either because lots of Greeks found themselves enslaved. Greek was simply not just a mere vehicle for self-government. But to our point. Starting in the 1770s, there was an active anti-slavery movement in Britain that, joined with the efforts of the slaves themselves, led first to the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade by Britain in 1807, and to the eventual abolition of slavery by Britain in 1834, and the complete arrival of emancipation for Britain's former slaves in 1838. Now, this was an achievement that took immense effort and required not just the efforts of West Indian slaves and British humanitarians, but also a completely and totally genuine revolution in another Caribbean territory, Haiti, that put the fear of the Lord into slave owners who could not, after the Haitian Revolution, state that black people were inherently inferior or expect that slave revolt would simply be put down after a brief while. The Haitian Revolution proved that the former slaves were just as capable, just as competent, and just as ferocious as their would-be overlords. And it put to rest forever the idea that white people were supreme over black people. So, on the 1st of August, 1834, slavery ceased to be legal in Britain's Caribbean territories. It was replaced immediately by something called the apprenticeship system, which meant that the former slaves had to work 40 hours a week for their previous owners. But the rest of the time was theirs and theirs alone. And this is an immense change. and involved negotiations. It involved the British government sending out magistrates to arbitrate between the former slaves and their former owners. It involved real negotiation between free black people and white people. It involved the ability of slaves to completely slip out of their indentures by payment of termination fee, actual emancipation fee. So it was the end of a horrible era. But was it perceived in that way? When complete emancipation came in 1838, except on the island of Antigua, where it had come in 1834, large numbers of former slaves turned their backs on the plantation and set out to become free and independent peasants or workers or fishermen. And plantations found themselves in increasing amounts of trouble through significant shortage of labour. This was followed by a decision by the British government in the 1840s to abandon traditional protection for colonial trade in favour of a free trade policy, initially in grain, but then in other agricultural commodities, that resulted in Britain importing cheaper sugar from Brazil and from India rather than the more expensive sugar from the West Indies that had hitherto been the mainstay of the colonial economies. The result was that the plantation economy went into a tailspin. Planters were bankrupted. Estates were being sold for pennies on the pound. And it was a major disaster if you happened to be a plantation owner from the West Indies living in England on the income from your estates, and that income suddenly dried up. You were in a horrible state. It was terrible. And you complained loudly to everybody who could hear how the abolition of slavery had ruined you, just completely ruined you. Now, to a lot of people, including everybody who had been a slave, this was, shall we say, less than compelling. But for some people, it was. And why was it compelling? Well, it was compelling because they considered the plight of black people in the West Indies to be less important than the plights of some other people, such as that of white people in Ireland, who were, in the middle of the 1840s, suffering from one of the worst famines in modern European history, which was receiving literally no relief from the British government, even though the British government was the direct government of Ireland. As some people felt that it was extraordinarily hypocritical of the British government, on the one hand, to have listened to the cries of humanitarians and abolished slavery in the West Indies, while on the other hand, ignoring the cries for help of the Irish peasantry and letting them starve. Now, I am not in the position to go and judge between humanitarian causes, nor should you be. But suffice it to say that both of these causes were driven by very similar ideals of individual liberty, in which, in one case, the absence of liberty was to be cured by the granting of it, and in another, Irish peasants were supposed to use their liberty to decide whether they should stay and starve or flee with whatever resources they had to some other place where there was work and food. The fact that Ireland's population to this day is still lower than it was in 1840 is one suggestion of what exactly freedom might mean in such a context. Be that as it may, in 1849, a Scotsman named Thomas Carlyle wrote an essay. Now, the essay was in the form of a public lecture, and he may have given it as a public lecture, though it first appears as an essay in a magazine in December of 1849. and it was called An Occasional Discourse on the Nigger Question. I mean, that is precisely what he called it, and I don't like the word, but I'm stuck with it. Most references to it today refer to it as the occasional discourse. And when I wrote about it, I was asked to refer to it as the occasional discourse myself. So there's that to be considered. What's Carlyle's argument? Carlyle's argument is, as I've already indicated, that there is something fundamentally wrong with spending your resources on these poor, ungrateful Negroes in the West Indies who aren't deserving of your help, while ignoring people in Ireland who are. Besides which, Negroes don't amount to a hill of beans in terms of numbers, while the Irish number in the millions. Now, there are two arguments there, one of which is specious. Helping people on the basis of their numbers does not make sense to me. If you need help, you need help regardless of whether there's one of you or a million of you. On the other hand, Carlyle's argument about propinquity, that you need help more because you are closer in distance and race to the person providing the help, is also problematic. If I see you in need of help, whether you are across the street or in the next room, should I not help you because you're across the street? Those are real moral questions, and Carlyle dodges them. What he wants instead is for us to assume that there is a racial hierarchy, and he states this explicitly, that the Negro, as he calls people of color, is just a bit higher than the horse. And horses are pretty stupid animals. And he makes no difference between one kind of non-white person and another. The introduction of a type of serfdom by the Dutch in Java is something he welcomes as the treatment of one kind of Negro, even though the Javanese would object very strongly to being called Negroes, and black people might object very strongly to being classed in the same way as Javanese. The idea of European superiority, of European supremacy over non-European peoples, is something that had developed over the course of the 17th and 18th centuries as a result of the European employment of large numbers of enslaved persons from West Africa. But this racism, ingrained as it was by the mid-19th century, caused Europeans to see themselves and the world in a hierarchical light, to see the world as a hierarchy in which the superior man was a European and the inferior man was a non-European, especially a non-European with a dark skin. Apparently, swarthiness of skin is a code for lack of intelligence and lack of ability. And Carlyle was all about ability. He believed that our rulers are, by nature, the most able. And if they're not the most able, then we are in a degenerate state, and we need to fix this. How exactly we should fix this is not always clear, although Carlyle's preferred mode of governance is a military dictatorship. And more on that at some point, if ever I get to it. The other part of this is that Carlyle wants us to see dictatorship as the best mode for most people, but especially for people who are inherently inferior. We need to be governed by our betters. And who's better than any black person, than any white person? Now, Carlyle made this statement in the autumn of 1849. He was met with resounding anger. In a rival magazine, a writer, anonymous to this very day, called Carlyle's essay the fostering of a monstrous prejudice. And he was correct. In the same magazine, the next issue, Carlyle faced a broadside from a writer using the pseudonym D. D's argument was a simple one, that people who have been enslaved need to learn how to be free, and the evidence from the West Indies is that the formerly enslaved have been adapting to freedom very well, and what Carlyle has been doing is listening to the complaints of the former slave owners and taking reports of such things as labor strikes and turning them into fiery declarations that the world is coming to an end. In reality, things are not what Carlyle has said them to be. The former slaves are advancing in civilization and will eventually come to be the full equals of their former white masters. Indeed, D, John Stuart Mill, in actual fact, is quite sanguine about the prospects of the freedmen and freedwomen. He sees them as on a clear path to full human development, and he does not see it as anything other than an absurdity to say that they should be kept under tutelage, that slavery should not have been abolished, and that it is better for people of colour to be under white control than not. We thus have Carlyle facing first criticism for racism and then outright anti-racism in response to his broadside against emancipation. But Carlyle also had supporters. Though Carlyle himself never made it to the West Indies, some people did who supported him. One of these was the novelist Anthony Trollope, who, as his day job, worked for the post office and was sent out to the West Indies in the 1850s, the end of the 1850s, to set up arrangements for postal service in British Guiana, Jamaica, and some other places. And he had an interesting take on the free population of the West Indies. Now, what's important about Trollope is, first of all, that his mother had been a staunch critic of slavery as it was practiced in the American South. But Trollope himself did not see anything wrong with slavery. He found it not at all repugnant when he saw it in operation in Cuba, and he thought black people were not injured by it. On the other hand, he found free black people in Jamaica insolent because they would not give him the automatic deference he thought he deserved as a middle-class white Englishman. Indeed, he was deeply upset by the fact that a black man in Spanish Down, Jamaica, treated him with suspicion when he asked him a question. Trollope, of course, assumed that as a white person, he was above suspicion and was obviously a person of merit. He might have considered it from the position of a black man being stopped on the square in Spanish Town by a white man and asked for directions, who, first of all, needed to take a moment to understand the white man, since the black man's language and the white man's language were not the same, and second, who, when offered payment by the white man, waited for the payment, and asked for it, in fact. As Trollope records. And then Trollope, having been given directions to the nearest public house, goes in and is deeply upset to hear a person of colour talking about activity in the Island Assembly as if this is nothing unusual. Yet for Trollope, the idea that a person of colour could vote on matters that affected white people was horrible. And indeed, he quotes a Jamaican planter who said it was not possible even to die because it would be necessary to have your body examined by a black coroner. Now, the disgusting nature of this racial prejudice, this racism, is something that I, looking at it in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, can almost not bear. But for Trollope, it was in the natural order of things. Black people are inherently inferior and needed to be governed by white people who are naturally superior to them. However, Trollope does mediate this. He looks at people of mixed race and sees mixed race people as being the natural intermediaries between white people and black people. Our cousins, he calls us. Now, I'm not sure whether to be amused or to be even more annoyed at Trollope for this. Because to say of one group of subalterns that they're somehow less subaltern than the other, while still being subaltern, is not exactly a compliment. But there's Trollope. Goes to the West Indies with a set of preconceptions, leaves the West Indies with those same preconceptions, in the interim says that the West Indies is badly governed, even though the people governing the West Indies aren't the black people. Then we have Act Two of the Carlisle King, sorry, the Carlisle Mill debate, because something happens in Jamaica. In 1865, following years of drought and economic disaster, especially as a result of the American Civil War, which dried up Jamaica's principal supplier of processed food, in this particular case salt cod, the island was in a powerless state. In the autumn of 1865, there was a revolt in the southeast of the island, which was put down with severe force, unnecessarily severe force, by the colonial governor. As a result of that revolt, large numbers of people were arbitrarily executed, and one person who was arbitrarily executed was a mixed-race member of the Island Assembly, who was executed on trumped-up charges of treason. Emphasis on the trumped-up. He was executed by court-martial, having been taken from a place where martial law was not in force to one where it was, executed without chance of appeal, and hanged from a yardarm. This caused an immense scandal in Britain, where the idea that subjects of the crown could simply be arbitrarily hung struck people as a rather bad idea, everybody in Britain being a subject of the crown themselves. As a result, the governor, Edward John Eyre, was recalled to Britain. Not, however, before changing the Jamaican constitution to remove the island's charter and replace it with whatever the British crown desired, so that Jamaica's internal autonomy was brought to an end by the fear of the colonial planter class that another such revolt might happen, and the next thing you know, black people might actually really be in charge. But that's another kind of story. What happens then? Eyre is recalled to Britain, where he faces a private prosecution for murder. And that private prosecution is brought by essentially the whole of liberal England in what's called the Jamaica Committee. Basically, every man of science, every single social scientist comes together and says, what happened in Jamaica was wrong, and Governor Edward John Eyre needs to be prosecuted for it. And I have had a lot of trouble with people who will say, oh, people like Charles Darwin are racist. Charles Darwin subscribed money to prosecute Edward John Eyre for killing black Jamaicans. There is nothing in the world that will tell me that Charles Darwin was an enemy of black people. And there's my rant for the day. Edward John Eyre was supported by an Eyre Defence Committee. This included most of the major literary figures of the day, such as Charles Dickens, Charles Kingsley, and of course Thomas Carlyle. The Air Defense Committee managed to pay for the defense of Ear against two attempts to prosecute him for murder, both of which were nullified by jury verdicts, even though the Chief Justice of England charged the jury to find Ear guilty. The jury found no case in both trials. However, this particular scandal was important enough that one of the subscribers to the Ear Defence Committee, the novelist Charles Kingsley, visited the West Indies in the autumn of 1869. Now, Kingsley just went to the Eastern Caribbean. He sailed to Trinidad, where he spent a few months. And he had a mixed impression. He did not believe that West Indians were ready for self-government. However, he did at least talk to black West Indians, and he found some of them, such as the Trinidadian writer J.J. Thomas, worthy of respect and attention, even though all he could say of Thomas was that he was a good comic writer, something for which Thomas is not remembered today. Kingsley at least made an effort, and for all that he was still largely informed by his white contacts, he at least tried for some understanding of what it was to be a black West Indian. Carlyle's good friend and biographer, James Anthony Froude, on the other hand, visited the West Indies half a century after emancipation. He arrived in 1887 to see what had happened in the half century since black people had been freed in the West Indies. And Froude, following Carlyle, thought it had been a disaster. Now, Froude is what happens when you add a pinch of Darwinism to a lot of racism. You get descriptions of black people as being like monkeys. You get descriptions of black people in the West Indies as inherently inferior even to other black people. Froude thought West Indian blacks inferior to Zulus and Kaffirs he'd encountered in Cape Colony, the bottom of Africa. Froude thought it fun to joke about the possibility of importing bears to Jamaica where they could eat fruit and occasionally snack on black children. That for him was an amusing joke. The fact that I don't find it that funny might be attributed to my lacking a sense of humour, or it might be attributed to the fact that I would prefer the exercise start with James Anthony Froude. Froude thought that at least slavery had taught the British had taught their former enslaved good manners, a point that angered J.J. Thomas in his response to Froude. Froude spent a total of 4 hours in Haiti, and on the basis of those 4 hours was willing to say that the most horrible slanders about Haiti, including that Haitian women salted and cooked babies, were true. I mean, this was the most disreputable, dishonest, nasty, evil characterization of black people in the West Indies, and all of it ultimately deriving from Carlyle's argument that black people could not govern themselves and did not deserve to govern themselves. Indeed, Froude's argument is a very Carlylean one. Carlyle felt that in the modern world, people had degenerated from what they once were, that they had been proud Saxons, proud Germans, and now were degenerated from that once great racially proud people. Carlyle was followed by Froude, who saw the British in the West Indies as having degenerated from what they had been in the 18th century to now a far less proud people who could well be taken over by the Americans, who are still intact and proud white people. Again, Carlyle had said all this in 1849. And Froude was saying this with much more fervor in 1887. In 1849, Carlyle had received a response from white people in Britain who said, this is wrong. You can't say this. Black people are just as good as white people, and given experience, will be able to govern themselves. So far, John Stuart Mill. In 1888, there appeared in London a book called Froudacity, or The Audacity of Froude, written by J.J. Thomas, a black Trinidadian, the first black West Indian to speak up on the subject of who should govern in the West Indies. And Thomas's argument is the West Indians were able to govern in the West Indies. Now, by West Indians, Thomas does not mean black West Indians exclusively. He means West Indians, black and white and mixed race. But he is saying that West Indians are capable of governing themselves, that Froude was wrong, dishonest, and cruel in his depiction of West Indians, that statements such as the one he said that in encountering black people in Mandeville, Jamaica, who were courteous, he attributed that to centuries of experience under slavery, was simply wrong, that anybody who had encountered black people in Africa had reported on the exquisite and impeccable manners of West Africans. And that as for black inferiority, if you look at Liberia, you could see a well-managed black state. And if you look at black people like Frederick Douglass, you could see black people of ability as great as any white person's. Now, Thomas's argument was written within the same context of Carlyle's and Froude's and Kingsley's and Trollope's. All of them were making assumptions on the basis of Victorian values and shibboleths. They assumed, naturally, that white Western civilization, white British civilization, was superior to all others. They assumed that you could not beat Britain as the world power. And yet, J.J. Thomas, a black man, in his last days in life, his final illness, went to Britain and published an attack rebutting, indeed refuting, all that Carlyle, Trollope, Kingsley and Froude had said. When we come to the 20th century, to when black West Indians and other West Indians of colour finally come into their own, a subject on which I will have more to say, what we find is that it is, first of all, to the 19th century debate on who should govern the West Indies that they turn. And it is in J.J. Thomas that West Indians find their first champion against the voices that say that West Indians, black West Indians, should not govern themselves. And when a black West Indian arises to speak the words that say, we can, we must, and we shall govern ourselves, he does so very much echoing the language of Thomas.